Welcome to Let's Talk. Today, we're talking sovereignty. Here's your host, Tiger Bales.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tiger Bales. This is the very first Let's Talk forum, broadcast from the Brisbane Indigenous Media Association's headquarters in West End. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations across the continent. The Oxford Dictionary defines sovereignty as supreme power or authority, a self-governing state. However, words like sovereignty are foreign and Western terms of reference. The purpose of today's discussion is to take an in-depth look at the legal, political and philosophical intricacies of sovereignty from a First Nations perspective. Our four panellists, Michael Mansell, Mary Graham, Bob Weatherall and Little Watson, will discuss ways in which we as First Nations peoples can work towards achieving autonomy and true self-determination. First up, let me welcome Michael Mansell to the panel. Michael, tell us your people, your country.
Yeah, thanks, Tiger. It's good to be here. I've got a good and a bad side. They reckon that Trawler Way is the good part of me and Pinterer is the bad side. But in Tasmania, we're all one people, we're all together. And the traditional name for Aboriginal people in Tasmania is Pakana. So you'll hear Aborigines in Tasmania, so we're the Pakana people.
Now let's have a brief look at what Michael's history as part of the black political struggle.
A high school dropout, Michael Mansell came out of university in his early 20s as a qualified lawyer. Joining the fight for justice, Mansell marched the streets and lobbied government, playing a major role in the recognition of Aboriginal fishing rights, development of Tasmania's land rights legislation, and the nationwide campaign for repatriation of human remains from Australian and overseas institutions. A key player in the Federation of Land Councils, he went on to co-found the Aboriginal Provisional Government in 1990.
Michael Mansell was the lone voice of protest outside Parliament House when Mandela arrived this morning.
What about Aborigines, Mr. Mandela? Why doesn't someone say something about the Aboriginal people in this country?
Mansell caused quite a stir when he took a delegation to Gaddafi's Libya in the late 80s, confronted Queen Elizabeth with a petition for land rights and urged the use of the Aboriginal passport.
Let me now introduce Mary Graham. Mary, tell us your mob, your country.
Thank you, Tiger. My mob, on my father's side, the Combermere people from the Gold Coast, and on my mother's side, the Waka Waka people from up near Gander in southeast Queensland.
Now for an insight into some of what Mary has been involved in.
A published academic in the fields of Aboriginal history, politics and philosophy, Mary Graham has lectured and tutored on these subjects at the University of Queensland and at other educational institutions around the country. Mary was also a founding member of the Aboriginal and Islander Childcare Agency and has been on the boards and committees of many other Aboriginal organisations in Brisbane.
A heavy hand has been applied for far too long, for too many decades.
She worked in native title negotiation for 5 years with the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research Action and was a member for the ATIC Regional Council for Southeast Queensland. Mary currently does research with Kamara, an Aboriginal community development organisation, and she co-developed the Black Card course with Lilla Watson.
Now to Lilla Watson. Lilla, tell us your mob, your country.
I grew up in my grandmother's country, Kungaloo country, in central Queensland on the Dawson River there, and a very important place for all our family. And my dear father was a Birriggubba man further north. He was of the Wirree clan, which is just west of Mackay.
Thank you. Here's a glimpse of Lilla's role in the push for Aboriginal self-determination.
Lilla Watson has been instrumental in the push for Aboriginal community control, helping to establish Brisbane's Aboriginal and Islander Childcare Agency, Murray School and the Aboriginal Legal Service. Along with her involvement with the Brisbane Tribal Council in the early 70s, Lilla was part of the first delegation to China from the Aboriginal Embassy in 1972 and was also involved with the 82 Commonwealth Games protests. She has been an academic at the University of Queensland for the past several decades and co-developed the Black Card course, an innovative cultural awareness training project focusing on Aboriginal perspectives, terms of reference and approaches to politics.
Finally, our fourth panellist is Bob Weatherall. Bob, tell us your mob, your country.
Thanks, Tiger. I'm Gomeroi from out southwest Queensland, around the Ballon River and going down to the Darling River. It's a fairly large nation, as people understand and recognise, and yeah, that's basically my country from my mother's side.
Well, let's have a look at what Bob's been up to for the past few decades.
Bob Weatherall, also a key member of the Aboriginal Provisional Government and the Federation of Land Councils, was heavily involved in the landmark 1982 Brisbane Commonwealth Games protests. At the time, Bob was CEO of the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research Action, helping to muster support from across the country and the international community in calls for a boycott of the Games. As another veteran repatriation campaigner, he heads up both Brisbane's Centre for Indigenous Cultural Policy and the Kamilaroi Lands Trust in St. George. As well as engaging with domestic bodies like ATSIC and the APG, Bob was part of the United Nations Working Group on drafting the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples during the 80s.
So what does sovereignty really mean to First Nations people? Lila, can you tell us, what does sovereignty mean to you?
Well, Tiger, I see sovereignty as an English word, but it's become a convenient word for Aboriginal people to talk about sovereignty. Non-Aboriginal people, when they talk about sovereignty, it has only one meaning. When Aboriginal people talk about sovereignty, and we use that word, then it has multiple meanings. And it means Aboriginal law, means Aboriginal spirituality, it means our tens of thousands of years of history in this country. And that's what it means, and it means much more than that when Aboriginal people talk about sovereignty. And they're the meanings that need to be taken in consideration when non-Aboriginal people hear Aboriginal people talk about sovereignty.
Bob Weatherall, tell me what you think sovereignty is and what it means to you.
I think sovereignty to me, Dyke, basically represents our sovereign right. It's a birthright. It's our songs, our dance, our ceremonies and our laws. That's what basically gives me the song for my country. It's the language for my country. It's the ceremonies inside my country that basically tells me I'm Gomeroi. No other nation. Other nations recognise Gomeroi and their ceremonies, their significant places where they too have participated in ceremony with us, which legitimises us. So our status has always been there and always been recognised before the white invasion, and it still prevails today.
Mary Graham, can you tell us, what is sovereignty to you?
Well, essentially it's when I've looked at how the place of sovereignty throughout the world, it's seen as, for me, an instrument of oppression of Indigenous people, the way the West has used it, Western powers have always used it. But from our point of view, from an Aboriginal point of view, sovereignty is something that we're, in a sense, still kind of working out as far as the rhetoric or the actual technical meaning of it. But in actuality, it's our autonomous selves and our actions that follow from us being autonomous people. So we, as individuals, are autonomous, and our mob, various mobs, are autonomous also. And it's a very hard thing for, I think, the West to understand that, especially white Australians and white Australian governments. And I think of two examples. For example, the Catholic priest, Frank Brennan, who is considered, especially by himself, something of an expert on Aboriginal affairs. He had said some years ago something about that Aboriginal people should forget about sovereignty. It'll never be accepted. It will, you know, it's no good. We should just put it behind us or something. And then you look at that statement. Then you look at another statement by Justice Gray. He was talking in the Northern Territory. He was talking about native title business, and he did this paper on native title business. And the whole paper ended with an amazing sort of statement about the problem. Something along the lines of, the problem for Australian law is that Aboriginal people everywhere still consider the country theirs, which I thought was an amazing thing to say. Yeah. And quite right, of course.
Good on you,
quite
Justice
right,
Gray. You
know? Yeah, good on you, Justice Gray. He didn't realise the full truth of what he was saying, because even though we use the word ourselves, Aboriginal sovereignty, you know, even though it comes from somewhere else, that's really what it means, that we do indeed still consider the country ours, you know, all 3% of us against 97%. So it's a mixed bag, but I myself, personally, I think of it as our autonomy. So our acts of autonomy, acts of sovereignty and so on are the proof of it.
Michael Mansell, tell us your views on sovereignty. What do you think it means to you, and what sort of form or shape it might take?
Well, I've been cheating because I've been scribbling notes now. When people explain what sovereignty is, I'll claim them as my own. I think, accepting what the other panel members have said, I think the next question for us is, how does that Aboriginal sovereignty manifest itself into some meaningful way for Aboriginal people? And I think that what we've got to look at is representation of Aboriginal people internally, you know, within the Aboriginal community. The ATSIC model, was nothing wrong with it. The whole thing was based on Aboriginal representatives from all around the country meeting in one central point and discussing Aboriginal policy. I think that ought to be brought back in. But I also think that representation in the powerful institutions of Australia, like the federal parliament, should also be included. So we need to talk about that. You know, we need to put up ideas. And of course, it's no good to have representation if Aboriginal people remain dispossessed, because, you know, we have got some land back in Australia, but we haven't got enough land back. You've got some Aborigines who have got substantial portions of land that was lost to them, handed back, and you've got other Aborigines who've got absolutely nothing back. Well, there's nothing equitable about that. So I think that representation and land are key issues when you talk about how can sovereignty become a meaningful proposition for Aboriginal people today.
Lilla, would you like to talk about the different nations, the sovereignty, and the different language groups and dialects across the country before colonisation?
Yeah, I think that it's important that we show the Tyndale map, for instance, to show just how many Aboriginal nation states there were in this country, because there were at least, as that map is shown, you will see at least 300 different Aboriginal nation states on this great South Island home of ours. And to me, they're still there. They haven't gone away. They're still there. And that needs to be recognised and understood. This whole country still belongs to us. That needs to be recognised. It needs to be understood, because the people that have, you know, the first boat people that come here and just never went away, we ran this country for thousands and thousands of years without any outside interference of all from any foreign countries. We ran this country. Then these boat people come, these first boat people come, and they never went away. And they literally took over this country, because through force of arms and everything else that happens through colonialism. And as my friend and sister Mary always says, they got a country for free. They never paid a thing for it.
Now they're stopping the other boat people from coming.
Yes.
They did the same thing themselves.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And as Mary says, and they got a country for free. They made themselves rich out of our country. They owe us. They owe us much more than they can ever repay. And they need to start to come to terms with that. How then we come to an agreement between both of us so we can live in this country together and work out ways of how to do that. To me, that's what's important.
So Mary, is in coming to terms with this, does that mean that our people have control of their own rights, like self-governing communities or self-determination?
Well, definitely. Some form of independent life away from the control of the state with a small s, that is. You know, that has really got to be taken into account, our autonomy, as I said before. I think a whole lot of other cultures around the world, societies, I don't think they've had for centuries and centuries, or maybe even millennia, they've never been treated as autonomous beings. Either it was some kind of a monarchy, some kind of hierarchy of all, you know, in any country, whether it's Asia or Europe or anywhere else. And even when nationalism first came in, or with the idea of the social contract, Rousseau, and the social contract where...
You're getting the heavy stuff now.
Yeah. well, there was this idea, that it was like a contract. They would have this state with a small s, and the whole population would agree, basically, with the government, the state, taking over responsibility for things before, of running everything, the economy. So it was the beginning of the end of independent kingdoms and fiefdoms with their own armies and things like that. So the state took over a whole range of things, but it was a contract. They agreed, you know, the populace, and it's that idea spread out everywhere. So they've never been true autonomous beings, but we have, because every time you look at that map, that's what it's showing. And unfortunately, the people who've had the most to say about it is anthropologists and historians, and always trying to compare us to, like, wandering kind of, what's the classic kind of meaning? A primitive hunter-gatherer society struggling to survive in a harsh, cruel world.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's basically, that's the underlining thing of all of their thinking, really. And a lot of people in this country have never gone away from that. They really still think that, you know. But it's as far removed from that as possible. We really did run the country, not, you know, in this broader sense, the way white fellows talk about it, but without the state running things. It was autonomous people, clans, tribal groups within language groups and so on and so on. But the power, I think, I don't know if you'll say this, Michael and others, power was diffused, you know, it was through the group.
That's
you know,
Cox
it wasn't a hierarchy.
No hierarchy.
No chieftainship system or anything like that. And we really did run the country because that system, when you see on the map, has been in place for thousands of years. Yeah. Now, why we know it, we ran it in this straight political way is that it remained there without some other one particular tribe. Maybe they thought about it, but they didn't carry it through. They didn't take that step to trying to invade and run any other tribal group. There might have been lots of charismatic people,
yes.
People who might have thought of themselves as, you know, they want a bit more power, like what happened in many other cultures, you know, a charismatic chief type person, usually a man, getting a power base and then ruling over everybody else and creating a hierarchy. That never happened. And that's a huge question. Why didn't that happen over thousands of years?
Exactly.
It stayed that way and it didn't move. It changed to some extent because of geographical, just natural boundaries changing, you know, rivers changing their course, land, the sea reclaiming land, that's natural kind of stuff, but it stayed that way. And the most wonderful thing about it, I always think, when you look at that map, is that we not only had multipolarity, that's a multipolar kind of system, which is what they're trying to do now in the world, actually, you know, a multipolar, that is all these countries are independent of each other. The great Satan, you know, America, apparently, is losing its empire sort of, you know, its basis. It's going down. What followed from that, too, was that we had strategic cooperation. We really did have strategic cooperation between all of those autonomous, independent, interdependent groups. That is a huge, huge thing to say. And if that isn't sovereignty, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
Well, Bob, you got a comment on that? But I would like to ask you, can sovereignty be given to us by a government? Or by anybody? United Nations?
Definitely not. I can't see that actually. Whitefellas handing back the sovereignty and what have you. I can't see
they,
that.
They can have it acknowledged.
They can acknowledge it and recognise it and basically restore that, but not interfere with it. We must always be continuously, independent and self-governing and in control of our lands and our waters and our peoples, those sorts of things. You see, I think you've got to look at that Australia is still the only former British colony who hasn't come to any sort of agreement with Aboriginal nation states within Australia, as they was with Canada and America and other nations of the Commonwealth that the English have been involved in. It's not been addressed in the judicial system or in any sort of administrative way in any form of agreement or any type of treaty. So we're at that point now that where we basically have to put the bundle of rights that has been denied us for far too long to the government and basically to ourselves and come up with those rights and to make them very clear. Aboriginal people have always looked beyond the acts that governed Aboriginal people. Those were the things that suppressed our rights, our fundamental freedoms, took away every basic human right and fundamental freedom, and denied you to your continuous practice or your customs, your traditions and your belief systems. It denied you that. And we've wanted it for so long, and we've basically fought for it, we've advocated for it over and over and over, and we're still doing it today. And basically needs at this stage, I think, that Aboriginal people have got a starting point now to basically start clearly defining what we want in regards to sovereignty and to be able to have absolute control over our homelands. Like Gomeroi looks after Gomeroi land, Goongri, Mandandanji, Wiradjuri or anybody else should have that status recognised. It was always there. It had never been ceded in any voluntary way or any other way. And we've got to recognise the fact that wars have gone on in this country against us. Many of them undeclared war, like a 50-year war just here in Brisbane, went on for 50 years. Their status has still not been recognised in this country, and their rights to their lands, and they should basically have all those human rights restored to them.
Michael, What's the process then to get to get to this position of sovereignty where we're enacting sovereignty, where Gumuroi look after Gumuroi country, Pakana mob look after Pakana country?
Yeah, well, I just think that all of those things that have been said are terribly important because that's the foundation of Aboriginal society, and as we move through, we shouldn't lose sight of those. But I think we need to, in real focus way of answering your question, Tiger, if the Prime Minister of Australia at the moment, Tony Abbott, walked through that door, or another future Prime Minister, and said, OK, what do you blackfellas want? We will hand it over. You tell us what you want. We've got to be able to answer the question. And I think that what we're saying to him is that we need political representation so that we make the decisions about our own destiny. Mm. And the acknowledgement of our rights to make those decisions must dignify our history and our status, mm. and also that our right to self-determination. So that's the framework for it. How can it work? I think what they've got to do is, pick up Bill Shorten's idea. He's saying, look, you can't go on any longer like this with Aboriginal people so underrepresented in the federal parliament. You've got 150 white fellas sitting in the parliament, one Aboriginal. And Bill Shorten saying, so therefore you get more Aborigines in the quota system. But the trouble is, there's a big difference between having Aborigines in the parliament and having Aborigines in the parliament who can represent Aboriginal people. Because Ken White, the only Aboriginal in the House of Reps, he can't represent Aboriginal people. He has to represent the Liberal Party. So what we're talking about is representation. So Bill Shorten and others should, and Tony Abbott should be looking at seats in Parliament. And that would at least give us, if you had reps around Australia, 8 seats in the Parliament. That's one way of doing it. What else should, and I think that their single focus, those 8 Aboriginal delegates, is to push for self-determination once they get in there. And I don't know whether we can get those maps up, Tiger, that...
Yeah, you brought some maps over from... in regards to native title land or land currently owned by our people across
right.
this country.
Yeah. You see, the first map there, if we're going to talk to, if the Prime Minister says, okay, we'll have a look at Aboriginal representation in the Parliament, what else do you want? Well, the land is crucial to Aboriginal people's existence. And if we're going to have a land settlement, we need to be able to point out where the lands are in Australia that we're interested in. Now, in that first map, it shows the existing Aboriginal land ownership under land rights and land vested in Aboriginal people through native title, and it combines both of those. There's a second map that adds to those areas of land that Aboriginal people have claimed as native title but have not yet successfully been granted the recognition of that. So that's the second map. Now that map there has added the native title claimed areas but which have not yet been granted. Well, they should be included as well, because if Aborigines are saying, look, that's our traditional land, we mightn't be able to prove it under the technicalities of native title, but that's our land. And for those Aboriginal people around the country who say, well, we can't even prove that, it's so technical, so ridiculous a test, that we know that our land was taken from us, but we just can't prove that ridiculous test that they put in front of us. There's a third category, and the third map that I brought up is the map of Tasmania that was brought out by the women in 1992 when the APG had its national meeting in Hobart. And you'll see from there, as an example of how Tasmania did it, the areas that's blacked out is Crown land, and the Aboriginal community said, that is the land that we know is ours and we want returned to us. Now, some of that land has been returned in land rights, small bits of it, but not all of it. And around the rest of Australia, other Aboriginal people too could say, we can't prove native title, we've got no land rights legislation, but those areas out there are our traditional lands, we want them back as a land settlement. And so I think that's the sort of thing that we could say to Tony Abbott or whoever, or Bill Shorten, we want proper political representation, we want another ATSIC-type model, but with powers of a state government, the same powers that the white fellas exercise, and then we also want representation in the federal parliament as representatives of us on top of our land settlement.
Lilla, what are your thoughts?
Well, it seems to me that, of course, many Aboriginal people, I agree with a lot of what's being said. Myself, I really don't care if we have people in Parliament or not. It might be a good thing if there's places created for Aboriginal people to be in Parliament and have a voice, but that's all it'll be. It'll be a voice, and I don't believe it'll have any power. And I think I don't believe in voting. I don't believe in voting at all. I believe in the system that Aboriginal people created here over thousands of years and have maintained in many areas that of consensus. And I think once you start voting, you create division. You're always going to have losers, and losers are never very happy. That's how I see voting, and I think it's been an absolutely... I'm going off on a tangent here, but it's been absolutely, absolutely destructive.
Tangent away.
Democracy has been the most destructive force in the world today. It's been so destructive, and I think it's absolutely a disaster if Aboriginal people start to vote against each other. When it comes down to land, for me, and we're all going to be working at different levels, Aboriginal people are going to put their effort into different levels. For me, it's got to be a treaty or bilateral agreement of how we work out, how we're going to all live in this country together. That's important. But this whole country, we have not ceded one inch of this country to any foreign power. We have not. This whole country still belongs to us. They're just a mob of thieves, as far as I'm concerned, still feeding off our country and making themselves rich. And I want a treaty. I want a bilateral agreement. And, you know, Aboriginal people have always been so willing to share knowledge, to share what we have with other people who've come here. And no one, you know, has ever come to us with goodwill to say, how do we share this country?
Well, it's really, like Lynn was saying, it's long overdue, is the recognition of Aboriginal people's autonomies and rights to their lands and land ownership. I mean, we have been given or imposed upon us an enormous amount of types of legislature throughout Australia that impedes all our rights. It never basically gives you back that full right that you actually have, just say, for your cultural property.
What's the answer then?
Well, the answer, I'll tell you that in a minute. Shut up. The thing is that we don't own that cultural property. That legislation removes that from you. They've removed our land, so they removed our children as well. So, and they took our ancestors as well. This is how crazy a type of society is that basically wants to have ownership. They want to interpret it to yourselves and to us. And therefore, basically, they place us on the lowest level of the economical, social, cultural ladders within Australia. And they seem to utilise those as reasons for not giving us those just rights that we deserve.
But if he's offering it to us...
I'm not talking about Tony Abbott.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
In any sense of the word, he doesn't come into my equation whatsoever. It's about what my people want on their country.
Absolutely.
And what they need to be able to go forward with the capacities and the abilities within their own communities to continue their practices and conducts, that we know what is our obligations and our responsibility through our customs, traditions and belief systems. Whatever Tony Abbott's going to do, he is going to do. We've got no control of that. Same as Noel Pearson. Noel Pearson will go and do what he wants to do, but it's going to be up to Tony Abbott and people like that who can sit down with us and come to an agreement about our status within this country of sovereign people. Once they start to recognise us as status people who have ownership and sovereignty of our homelands...
Well, they can't recognise their sovereignty because they'd say that's undermining their sovereignty.
Well, that's right. They've impaired that through all those pieces of legislations. But if they are going to basically rectify the wrongs of the past and bring some kind of equability within the Aboriginal societies throughout Australia, then they now have to come together. They can't leave it any longer because they're still seen as a people who have never, ever been really concerned in regards to Aboriginal rights. They might be concerned about making sure we're on welfare, and that continuation to basically deprive us all those other rights, but do all these other sorts of symbolism type things, but never give back the right.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. We have a video question that will be put to us.
Hi, my name's Samantha Bradbury. I'm an international relations and diplomacy student at Bond University. And my question is, how does a white Anglo-Australian fit into the sovereignty argument for Black Australia?
What are your thoughts there, Mary?
Oh, boy. Well, two things. First of all, I agree totally with the idea of a treaty too, a treaty between Aboriginal peoples across the country and all the individual autonomous clan groups around the country. I agree with that. The second thing in relation to that, I would say to Tony Abbott, first of all, I'd give him a good lecture on how to be a gentleman, you know, because he's a misogynist bastard, you know,
rat.
who needs to learn a lot about how to treat women and how to talk to women and not to be so frightened of women, and not to be so frightened of Aboriginal people either. And then I'd turn it back and ask him a question. Look, you and a whole lot of other Australians, especially the ones in government and in general, have to wonder about or ask yourselves, what kind of a country do you want to live in the next 100 years or 500 years? But at least, let's be generous and say, at least 100 years, you know?
Give them, but let me interrupt you.
So they have to think about it.
No, I know.
It's all related to that. Because we have to sort of sit down, and talk about that, especially what kind of a country do we want to live in? And then that's where the idea of, as Bob said, treaty. This is the only English-speaking common law country in the world that doesn't have a treaty with the Indigenous people, the only one. So they've got to catch up sometime. And I think through that, this whole treaty process, that is agreements, legal agreements, and I know there are already some kind of an agreements there now, you know, I think between groups and the local government, because I think it'll only ever happen on a local basis. I think it could really work on a local basis between the clan groups, the traditional people's areas, and the local governments, and make it a really solid treaty. And then on a national basis, a kind of like a charter of principles, I suppose, upholding that and recognised in the Constitution, you know, that it is a legal basis that we have now got this agreement about how to treat one another. A whole range of things, though, not just, you know, kumbaya, everybody loves one another in a reconciliation type way. It's all a load of rubbish, that is. It won't happen. It won't happen like that. It won't happen. A lot of arguments have to be really sorted out, real hard arguments, the native title issues, deaths in custody, all the ones that are all, they're like open running sores they are in our lives all across this country. Eh? They have to be fixed up first, and then we talk about, if we talk about it all, any kind of thing to do with reconciliation. So to me, to answer that question, that young girl, I think that's how we'll build a good relationship via treaties, because Australians, mainstream Australia, will play their part in these different areas. Because modern white Australia is only 200 years old. They're a work in progress. We're old, you know. We're old. We're not looking for the meaning of life or anything like that.
You looked straight at me when you said old.
I did not. Well,
I'd just be interested to make the comment in how many Aboriginal people actually identify as Australians, and
hardly
I don't
any.
Think
no,
there are very many
no.
Aboriginal
that's,
people
that's
at all.
That's true, Lil. I know, because I on the first reconciliation program, which I was on, council. It just arose just spontaneously that all the blackfellas on that council, about a dozen of us, we all said we're not black Australians, we're not Aboriginal Australians, we're Aboriginal, full stop.
Yeah.
And it really shocked all the whitefellas there. It really did. They didn't know what to say. They weren't expecting that. And I think the impression was that, boy, this is going to be harder than they thought. And I thought, well, that's good, that's right.
You know, that's quite right. Australians find that difficult to accept.
Yes, yeah. But, oh, sorry. Go on.
Michael, what do you think?
Well, Michael?
Well, I mean, that young girl there, in the same way as you don't have to be a woman to campaign against the injustice of rape.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You don't have to be black to campaign against the injustice of dispossession and denial of... And the domination is the 200 years we have been dominated to such an extraordinary degree.
Mm.
And when you look at the disadvantage, it's a product of that domination. And so we need all the support of willing people who want to join the campaign for justice, because that's what we're talking about. And my answer to that young lady was, look, if you want to join in the campaign, you don't have to be black to help us join in that campaign.
I think there's an example of what's happened in the past when you had Uju Nunnuckle and you had Judith Wright and you know, Stuart Harris and people like that, and senators, Margaret Reynolds and others, who basically put together the Treaty Committee way back then, and they encouraged all folks to participate in it. And it went down the road towards the treaty, and we were getting there. All we now need to do is allow, basically show the avenues or the paths that people can go back to. This is a student, then I think that obviously the students should have a treaty committee that they can be involved in, and they can undertake activities and things like that, as well as black student unions throughout Australia, who must have a major responsibility in dealing with and cooperating or participating with those other non-Indigenous or Aboriginal students within those universities. It starts to become more organised about what we need to do, and people will then be getting more information, and they won't be getting misinformation.
Lula, would you like to comment?
I want to go back to talking about identifying as Australian, because Aboriginal people, I mean, our history goes back so many thousands of years, you know, 60,000 years. I mean, we became human in this country. That's all there is about it. We became human in this country. And when you put that up, those thousands of years, when you put them up against, what, 200 years plus a few more years?
Plus 25 or so.
I mean, that's like a blink of the eye, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how can anybody expect us to identify with something, you know, that's happened in the blink of an eye? I mean, that's just impossible. Doesn't even make sense.
And on that thing about Australia, like, I don't know whether Cameron can get a shot of that. Can you? But, you know, you talk about, I mean, I'm not an Australian, and I'm talking about getting Aborigines into the federal parliament, but I don't vote because I'm not entitled to, because I'm not an Australian, I'm an Aboriginal. But if Tiger or Bob Weather or Mary or you, Leela, are standing for parliament, I want to be a vote for my own people. And that passport, that's my identity. I don't travel overseas with a white passport, I travel in the black passport. And
yes.
Use it as a form of identity. The kids love it. You know, it's just a wonderful way of saying we're proud of who we are and what
Absolutely.
We represent.
Absolutely. Can I ask, do Whitefellas use this passport? Has Whitefellas ever used this passport?
Not the Aboriginal one, no.
No?
It's
no,
only issued
no.
to
It's only
issued
to Aboriginal.
Aboriginal.
Oh,
people.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Mm. Mary, I want to put to you...
We discriminate.
Yes, no, I don't.
The assimilationist policies, past and present, is one of our biggest issues, challenges, problems. We're as divisive amongst our people. Now, to progress the sovereignty discussion, movement, we've got a lot of our mob that are so assimilated that they're saying, oh, forget about the past, we can't ever be sovereign, they'll never give us sovereignty. What do you say to that?
I'd say they're talking too soon, you know, because we've got a long way to go to educate the mainstream, really.
But amongst their own mob.
Yeah, I know. People... the ones, especially, say, I think there's, well, I don't know what the exact numbers are, we can't tell, the ones who want to have our, go with the recognition in the Constitution, that is a red herring. That is a red herring. It's not worth the paper it's written on or going to be written on. It's a key part of assimilation, just like leadership programs and so on and so on. It's not to say that Aboriginal people don't have leadership qualities, but they do. They have leadership qualities, but the idea of having a hierarchy, you know what I mean? That kind of thing is simply not our thing.
So you don't want Bob as chairman of the APG? Put a woman there.
Yeah,
so
I want to be the chairman of the APG. No, we can both be the chairman of the... we can both be the chairpeople of the APG, you see. It could be a lateral system. But that's the thing about assimilation. Look, it's insidious. It's happened everywhere colonialism has happened because they know... the colonising powers, they know that here is the Indigenous people, the native peoples, even if there is a treaty, basically, even those countries that have had a treaty, you know, sometimes they've been broken and so on, but they know that generally here is a people with a grievance. Somebody has came in and taken over their land, taken their land away from them, basically. So they will always have a grievance. So they know the powers that be, the state, that they have to have assimilationist policies, either really harsh ones, just straight out direct control, you know, taking land away straight, you know, just, you know, all the cruel things, but also the very indirect kind of assimilationist things too.
Let me interrupt a minute. We've got a video question that we need to see and hear. and respond to?
My name is Bakiri Ruska. I'm a Gurrumpur woman from North Shrimbrook Island, up there off the east coast of Queensland. I'm currently living in Victoria and was recently asked by Tawiri, which is the Association of Indigenous Law Students and Lawyers down here in Victoria, to debate on constitutional recognition and whether it would lead to better outcomes for Indigenous people. Now, I chose the negative team and argued that constitutional recognition would not lead to better outcomes. Our team debated that we should instead be looking at a treaty of sovereignty, that any amendments to the constitution would continue to allow for racist legislation to be implemented, and further, that constitutional change would not close the gap and it would be purely tokenistic. Now, my question for the panel is, what do they believe will lead to better outcomes for our First Nations people, and what role does sovereignty have in reaching these outcomes?
Michael Mansell, would you like to respond to that young lady?
Yeah, because you don't have to have constitutional reform to prevent racist or overwhelming legislation coming from outside that has a negative impact on Aboriginal people. If you have an Aboriginal assembly in Australia, say based on the ATSIC model, but you give it the powers of the state, and the federal parliament passes legislation to give that Aboriginal assembly the status of a state, so it's still part of Australia, but it's just got these powers that it didn't have previously, then no one has the power over that Aboriginal assembly to pass laws that affect Aboriginal people without that assembly agreeing to it. So you don't have to change the constitution. If you have something like that, which is existing arrangements, the assembly says, look, okay, we've got our own set of rules and laws that govern Aboriginal people. We can change them, but nobody else can. And if you had another state or a federal parliament who tried to interfere, you'd point to the constitution, the existing provisions, to say, no. No one under the Constitution of Australia has the power to override this Aboriginal Assembly. The Constitution protects us.
Well, that Assembly should have powers that basically, where there are discriminatory type things that exist, whether it's in the Constitution or in legislature across the place, it would be responsible of making sure that those things are eradicated. And they, if we have an Assembly as such, and we have good representation of our people within the states, from the states, and doing that, then I think, because it's very important, I'm trying to get back to that, we need to have some kind of black forum within this country. And if it turns into becoming an assembly, and in the end results to basically spearhead our rights and interests and those to address those things, and it's a government then that is accountable to Aborigines, and I would see that would be a damn big plus for Aboriginal people. Because I don't think it should be argued against, because I get straight in my mind, I got to look at Europe. You've got France, Germany, then you've got Irish, Scotland and Wales, and they all live beside each other, but they're all like different tribes, all different laws and different governments and whatever.
Exactly.
We've been doing this
for
years and years.
That's multipolarity. That's what it is.
Okay. Yes. Try and hold on to that.
That's
and,
what we need to head towards.
Yeah. And, but
I'd like to have a look at this video question. Those couple of points you want to make. Let's have a look at this video question and come back.
How can sovereignty address the continuing genocide of First Nations people, such as deaths in custody, overrepresentation in prisons, youth suicide, and life expectancy?
Would you like to answer that, Mary?
Oh, gee.
Or Michael?
All those issues that he mentioned. I think it's hard to say that sovereignty will solve those things. Just say if by some magic sovereignty was recognised, because as you said before, it can't be granted. It's got to be recognised. We would have to have actually the the resources, or the proper resources would have to be available, but under our control, though, under our control. Because as we know, I think Aboriginal Affairs budget is like billions of dollars.
$25 billion.
I didn't know it was that
much. It doesn't all go to Aboriginal people.
No, that's what I mean.
$25 billion.
No, that's what I mean. A great majority of it doesn't even go to Aboriginal people or Aboriginal Affairs, Aboriginal Housing or whatever. The great bulk of it goes in pure administration, mainly all around. It goes to the states, which we never have accountability for either, by the way. But also it goes to pay thousands, tens of thousands of mortgages of white fellas, actually, house mortgages and their bills and so on and so on. So it employs mainly white fellas, not black fellas, actually. So somehow we would have to have real control, real substantial control, not this artificial economy that has been imposed on everybody. So to answer that question, I think sovereignty, it will come only when we can actually control those things, and that will come out of a treaty. And the girl before, the previous question, I think it's a treaty is what we've got to go for. But the problem with, I don't see a, well, how can I put it? I'm trying to say yes and no at the same time. Two bob each way. The idea of an assembly is right. It's got to be some kind of setup. That is quite right. But
that
got
will
to
never replace the treaty.
No. Oh, no, not in place. I'm talking about if there is, with the treaty too, if there's some kind of an Aboriginal government. But it can't be too hierarchical. It can't be hierarchical at all, really, because, honestly, that's where a whole lot of things just fall down. Because sooner or later, it's going to take on all the attributes, features of the Western system. And the Western system, for their own people, for their own mob, it's an oppressive system. They are not in charge of their own lives, economically, socially, culturally, and so on. It's that hierarchy of very wealthy people and the friends of people in government, their wealthy mates and so on and so on, certain vested interests. They're the ones that run their countries. Their freedom is a very, it's a very select freedom. And that's why they keep raving on about democracy. It's like Lilla was saying, it's not so great. You know, democracy started as a kind of safe, an escape for serfs and slaves. And here we are, an ancient culture that never had serfs or slaves, slavery or anything like that. We're already freeborn, autonomous beings. So it's a completely different sort of setup.
Lilla, would you like to respond to that young lady? You've got a few other points you want to pick up on about multipolarity.
Well, I've almost forgotten what she said now, but it seemed to me that
The young fellow that was up on the video question.
I wanted to say about assimilation first, because there's lots of Aboriginal people who want to live an assimilated life, and I think, and that's fine, but in the process, it's not their word that is going to guide what is Aboriginal affairs and what is an Aboriginal treaty, because we know that the event of colonialism has interfered so much in our lives that lots of people have taken up white terms of reference to live by. Whereabouts Aboriginal terms of reference to me is what Aboriginal people will guide them to what a treaty is and how we are going to negotiate living in this country. And to me, Aboriginal people, there's a lot of confusion amongst a lot of our people, and sometimes they're operating on white terms of reference.
Yes, that's right.
And sometimes they're operating on Aboriginal terms of reference. And at the same time, the government is battering us all the time with assimilationist leadership things and this education and everything else as battering Aboriginal people to be assimilated and become like white Australians. So as far as I'm concerned, this causes the confusion, especially in young people. Who cannot see any positiveness, anything positive for themselves in the future. And it leads to these dreadful things of suicide and you know, drugs and alcohol and so on, because they cannot see a positive future for themselves. And also, a lot of those young people getting dragged into white terms of reference and see them, you know, they want to join in with the Western society. It's very seductive.
Very seductive.
And that's understandable. And that's why we need to arm our young people with cultural knowledge
In terms of
and
reference.
Build their strengths in order to see that we can work towards a positive future and we can have a treaty.
All right. Before you start, Bob, just hold that one. Okay. Make a note of it if you would, mate.
Yeah.
Got another video question that's just come in.
My name is Cassie Tim, and as a young Aboriginal woman who's not really interested in politics and is pretty happy with the way life is right now, why should I care about sovereignty or treaty?
Bob Wetherill, why should she worry about sovereignty or treaty?
She may choose that, and she has every right to not be a part of it, but shouldn't become a problem to it, but should become a part of the solution, really. I think Lilla's just given a really good response in regards to how people have been influenced, or by the white system and the white ways of thinking. I'm not saying that that lady is thinking in that sense. She has a choice, and she's got a right to choose. And we're going to find that if Aboriginal people choose a particular society and dual citizenships and whatever else, and want to follow hamburgers and Coca-Cola culture, well, that's up to them. That's that. But the people who want to continue to practice their customs and traditions and belief system should also be able to prevail. I just wanted to go back to that young man next, because he raised an interesting question.
He's a countryman for you, that fella.
Yeah, that's right.
He voted for you.
I hope he has. We'll have to get him to join up with the APG so he can take a vote. But I think he's hit the nail on the head or something. OK, what are you blokes going to do about this? We have to start decolonising.
Mm-hmm.
It's a process.
Absolutely, Bob.
And
yes.
What happens is it starts from here.
Mm.
You have the forums. So you've got black consciousness raising. You've got political awareness raising. People can then get themselves informed and basically play their role. And like that other first young lady that came in from Bond University, where do I find my role inside the struggle? Well, I've always said there is room for everybody to be inside our struggle. We've seen in our campaigns over the many years, Auntie Jeannie Phillips, for example, she'll go and make lamingtons.
She'll and sandwiches and dinners and lunches.
And she'll cook the curry and rice so that curry we can sit down and meet. Elders and that look after your children. Somebody sweeps the floor and empties the bins in the organisation. They're all playing a role. And the other ones are sitting up at the high level and negotiations and basically doing the work on their behalf. But they are a very significant persons in those actual areas.
You're canvassing for votes.
Yes, I am. And the thing is that if I can encourage more people to take up the fight for Aboriginal people and to help decolonise. The other way of decolonising is what we've just done out in the southwest Queensland with Gomeroi, was basically revive our burial ceremonies, people going through ceremonies. So our song, our dance and our ceremony and laws are now known by other peoples within our community of our clans. And so they now can pass that on, and that is something else. So that's empowering people. Get to know who they are. They identify Gomeroi. They are stronger for it, and so that they are going to be an enormous help and a great instrument to drive things further, even after we're gone.
Well, it's getting close to time. We have to wind up. But make your last point.
I'd really like to say this, and that is to say that while Aboriginal people have been affected by the event of colonialism, white people have been affected by the event of colonialism too.
Yes.
And they need to understand what has happened. Yes.
Mm.
They need to understand what has happened to them in that process, because they also need to decolonise.
And definitely. Yeah.
What has turned them into, well, Australia is well known as being a racist country.
It's well known around the world.
And what, Look, I mean, it's
human
bad
rights.
Enough how they've treated Aboriginal people, but look how they treat these poor refugees.
Yes,
I
asylum seekers.
I can't
seekers.
Believe the treatment these people treated as criminals. They're not criminals.
Mm. Yeah.
They're people seeking sanction from all the terrible things that happened to them.
Well, on that note, it is time to wind up, and I think there's a great point that you make, Lilla, that is you. Mainstream public, everybody, but mainstream public particularly, white Australians, need to look at the effects of colonisation on yourself. You need to decolonise. So look into it, suss it out. In closing, I'd like to thank all panel members for your participation in this very important discussion. This issue of sovereignty is not just a black thing. All who call our country home have an obligation to know and understand this issue, which assists us in knowing our roles and responsibilities. We must all strive to work together to create a better place and real quality of life for our future generations. And thank you all again for your efforts and contributions. We also want to hear your thoughts, You can let us know by messaging us on Facebook or sending us an email. Let's talk at 989fm.com.au. I'll now ask Stephen Oliver to close the program with one of his poems.
I contemplate and have a thought. What if truth was really taught? What if books didn't glorify the time that Captain Cook arrived? What if they instead told us that Terra Nullius was unjust, that he never had no right to claim this great land in Great Britain's name? Would there be more of empathy? Would understanding come to be? Would we no longer have to fight for that which is just simply right? Would our voices have a say? Would my people find their way? Would others come and share with us our pain and say, enough's enough, my head so full of many what ifs, I cannot help but wonder this and start to dream one day I'll see my what ifs are reality.